we must restore meaning to the great ideas, partly conflicting ideas, by which mankind is still living. The ideas of liberalism, democracy, and communism. Yes, the idea of communism.
Hi, and welcome to Marxism in Our Time, a podcast of Marxist ideas and debate from the Deutscher Prize Committee. Many thanks for tuning in. The Deutscher Prize is an award given in honor of the memory and work of leftist intellectuals Tamara and Isaac Deutscher, and is awarded on a yearly basis to a book exemplifying the best and most innovative new writing in or about the Marxist tradition. My name is Vincent Harding, and in each episode I'll be joined by a different member of the prize committee, or fellow comrades, in hosting an author of a book that made it to our 2022 shortlist, to discuss the main themes of their work and its relation to Marxism. The winner of the prize in 2022 was Gabriel Winans' The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America, published by Harvard University Press, and he will deliver this year's Deutscher lecture in November. But in this podcast, we will be discussing the other impressive books that made it to last year's shortlist, in a way that is accessible and can help to bring their core arguments to a wider audience than usual academic circles, thus providing valuable resources for the left. Today, for our first episode of the season, we're joined by feminist political economist Alessandra Mezzardi, reader in SOAS University, and our guest is Silvia Federici, presenting and discussing her latest book, Patriarchy of the Wage, Notes on Marx, Gender and Feminism, published by PM Press in 2022. Silvia Federici is professor emerita and teaching fellow in Hofstra University in New York State, and her contributions to Marxist feminist theory are well known, such as in her important piece, Caliban and the Witch, Woman, the Body and Primitive Accumulation. Silvia, welcome. It is an honor to have you with us. Alessandra, I will now hand it to you to start the discussion.
So thanks a lot, Vincent, and many congratulations, Silvia, for this very well-deserved recognition of the impact and relevance of Patriarchy of the Wage, and for the shortlisting for the Deutsche Prize. Let me start this interview, which is such an honor to hold, to celebrate this book, with a question on the chief objectives of the book. So in the introduction of Patriarchy of the Wage, you introduce its main aim as twofold, that is stressing on the one hand the crucial relevance of reproductive work, an issue omitted in Marx's own writing, and highlighting the fragmentations and divisions within the word proletariat, which is actually an issue you discussed previously as well in Caliban and the Witch. Can you take us through these two key objectives of the book?
Yes, I think it's very important. You know, I've been very influenced in my feminism by Marxist theory, by Marxist work. At the same time, like many other feminists, I've recognized, you know, an important limit, you know, to Marx's perspective on capitalism and anti-capitalist struggle. And the limit is precisely related to Marx's oblivion, in a way, to the question of reproduction. And reproduction, the reproduction of the working class. Actually, this is not completely accurate. You know, Marx speaks of the reproduction of labor power, but he only sees this reproduction as taking place through the market. You know, as I wrote in the book, Marx described the reproduction of labor power as in the following way. The workers earn wages, and with those, they buy the commodities necessary for reproducing their daily life. The whole issue, you know, of the work that goes, and particularly the domestic work that goes into, you know, reproducing a workforce, it's absent. And there've been many, many speculations why Marx didn't see this work. And one is that, of course, women were involved, particularly younger women during the Industrial Revolution. They were busy working in the factories all day long. The reproduction of the working class was kept to a minimum. And in fact, workers were dying very, very early. But I don't think that this is sufficient. And I think part of my aim, you know, in the book was to show how important it is to reintegrate this fundamental strategic sphere of activities that historically, particularly in the history of capitalism, have been carried out almost exclusively by women. How important is it to actually put the spotlight in order to understand what is the organizational work? What do we mean when we mean by the capital exploitation? Knowing that this work has been invisibilized, naturalized, it has been not considered as work. It has been actually by the whole left tradition, beginning with Marx, seen outside of the sphere of capitalist relations. So what I wanted to show in the book was actually that as many feminists have pointed out and have analyzed, this work is within the sphere of capitalist relations. It is a form of capitalist production. It is the production of the most important commodity in the capitalist organization of work, which is the worker. So this was one of the aims, and illustrating, what are the consequences of not seeing this work, right? And of course, connected, very deeply connected with it, the issue of the division that capitalism has implanted within the working class, precisely, by the division of labor. Marx is very, very interested in the division of labor and critical of the division of labor, but he does not see clearly the consequences of the division of labor as they affect men and women. It does not devote any analysis, to the gender hierarchies that are constructed, on the basis of the devalorization of reproductive work, on the basis of the naturalization of reproductive work. And in fact, it opens up a whole tradition, of left politics, which basically sees women's emancipation as joining men on in the factories, and equality with men being achieved, by engaging in industrial work. So I wanted to really use the book and an analysis of Marx's category and Marx's work, by highlighting these two main issues, which I think have been part of the revolutionary contribution of feminist theory. A contribution that does not erase the crucial, important, fundamental importance of Marx's work, but certainly puts it on a much broader basis.
Thanks a lot for this answer, Silvia, and for taking us through the main objectives of the book, and also for introducing a key issue which connects to my second question, which is related to the implications of this analysis for the revolutionary subject. So in the opening essay, Counterplanning from the Kitchen, you provide us with a novel revolutionary subject, right? So the housewife, the homemaker, the wageless become protagonists of the capitalist story. And I wanted to ask you, how does this analysis speak about your own political experience in wages for and against housework, and how this vantage point allows us to rethink the possible revolutions against contemporary capitalism?
Yes, okay. So first of all, I'd like to say that this kind of analysis has really transformed, the conception of the place of women in the anti-capitalist struggle, because in a whole left tradition, women were always cast in a supportive role to the struggle that male wage workers were making in the factories and so forth. And now with our analysis, we realize that women could struggle directly against capitalism in their own name, against their own exploitation. So this was a major transformation, not purely as support workers. Secondly, for me, of course, was a revolution, because it actually transformed my relationship to housework, to my mother, to the conception of my own life. And you know, all since the earliest days, my adolescence, I have fought against housework. If there was something that I didn't want to do in my life, was to become a housewife, because I've seen what it meant for my mother. Ironically, I've spent my life talking about housework and reproductive work and making struggles around this issue. I think the idea of wages against housework was crucial because we understood that unless we establish that this was actually work, this was work that was fundamental for capitalist accumulation, right? We wouldn't be able to, you know, denaturalize it, and we wouldn't be able to really subvert the division that capitalism has created within the working class through the separation and hierarchization of production and reproduction work. So for us, you know, to struggle was not only to denaturalize, to demand wages for housework, was not only to make visible what this work is, that this work, you know, benefits, yes, immediately, you know, the family and the recipient, but fundamentally benefits, you know, the whole capitalist class. Or in fact, you know, for at a minimal cost, you know, is able to reproduce continuously, daily, generationally, a workforce, you know, and also to overcome the division, the separation that capitalism has built, you know, through the naturalization and devaluation of this work. So I think it was extremely important to bring this strategy that was poorly understood, unfortunately, by many families, because wages for housework was often reduced to a labor union context, you know, as if a promise that we'll continue to work and do this work if we are paid, which was exactly the opposite, you know, of the objective of the demand. The objective of the demand was, in fact, to revolutionize, to change completely our relationship to this work. And in fact, to begin a process of reappropriation, begin a process of the reappropriation of wealth to which we knew generation of women had contributed.
And how do you think this still speaks for possible revolutions under contemporary capitalism?
Completely, because we see that over time, and this is definitely very, very important, over time, we have seen that the housewife, you know, and the reproductive workers, as we more and more began to, you know, define, right? In fact, you know, is a much more broader, is a much more complex figure than we certainly imagine in the 1970s. You know? And when we began to take a look at the international level, we realized that domestic work does not begin and end in the house. Across the world, as Maria Mies pointed out in Patriarchy and Accumulation on a World Scale, in most of the world, domestic work begins in the milpa, in the fields, means with subsistence-oriented agriculture. And that, in fact, reproduction, over the years, the notion itself of reproduction has widened to include the care for the environment, to include, as I said, subsistence-oriented agriculture. So that today, for example, we see that it is the reproductive worker, to use a more general category, right? It is women who are the fundamental subject of reproduction in their community, who are leading some of the most important struggle across the world. They are leading the struggle against, you know, for instance, deforestation. They are leading the struggle against the contamination of waters, rivers, lakes, you know, by petroleum drilling, by, you know, mining, but all the forms of all the extractivist politics that today are actually consuming the earth, you know? And they are in fact leading more and more the struggle and being the object of great violence because of it, you know? Because as the ones who are in charge, responsible for the reproduction of their family and their community, they realize that once the land is destroyed, once the waters are contaminated, you know, basically the destiny, the community, future is completely compromised, right? So the notion of the housewife has actually expanded, you know, into the notion of, you know, a political subject who is being in charge, being particularly primarily involved with the day-to-day generational reproduction of life, right, is in fact the one who is today, you know, in the front line, in a context in which we have a capitalism, right, who, because of its crisis, of its growing crisis, is trying to compensate, you know, by all kinds of predatory extractivist activities, by squeezing more and more human beings in their labor and squeezing the earth, and in this process creating catastrophic, you know, situation that, you know, as we now daily hear, it's putting in danger life itself on this planet.
Thank you, and thanks for mentioning Maria Mies, whom we just lost on the 15th of May. May she rest in power. Now, I wanted to talk about your relation to Marx and Marx's methodologies, because despite the omissions in Marx in relation to reproductive labor, in the book you also state that you agree with Marta Jimenez that Marx provides us, nevertheless, with the key methodology to look at labor and inequality. So how is the methodology in patriarchy of the wage compatible or complementary to Marx's historical materialism?
I think it's very compatible because I have taken from Marx's methodology the idea, the concept, social relation, you know, are not frozen, are not the essences, but they are continuously, historically reconstructed, you know, in response to crisis, in response to struggles in particular. Right. So this question of the concept of the mutability and also the methodology of looking at the material conditions of life, that to understand all social, cultural, political formation by, first of all, reference, you know, to the transformation in the material condition of life. This for me is something that has, in fact, shaped, you know, the concept of the book, you know, the work in the book and my own politics. You know, I look at in the patriarchy of the wage, right? I see the patriarchalism, you know, in a capitalist society. That's a very example of methodology. The test, the title itself, you know, is a exemplification of the methodology which I've taken from Marx. The patriarchy in capitalist society, you know, it's organized also, if not primarily, through the wage relation, through the hierarchies, right? So the patriarchy is a transhistoric concept, but nevertheless, it is not a concept that is universally defined. It's a constant that is mutable. And so what patriarchy, how it is organized, how it is enforced, it historically changes. And we have to look at the organization of the material condition and product, the devaluation of reproductive work, the devaluation of domestic work to which women have been increasingly confined. They had to make struggle, you know, in order to be able to enter into wage work in the 70s, in the 80s, etc. This is not, of course, universally true. Because we know that Black women, for instance, always had to have some sort of wage work. But nevertheless, the wage work the Black women had was always an extension of housework. So I think that the book is an exemplification of their methodology. which I today is extremely important. We talk much about identity politics and identity formation. Well, identity has to do with the material conditions of life. In order to understand how identities are formed, I've been insisting in my work that we need to look at, you know, the specific form of exploitation, for example, the women or men or sexually dissident subjects, you know, have been exposed to. You know, these identities are not created, you know, in a sort of cultural environment disconnected, you know, for the economic transformation. So this is what I've been trying to illustrate in the work, in the book.
Thank you. This was a brilliant answer. And also this distinction, it allows us to sort of reflect on the distinction between logics and concepts. And instead the historical instantiation of these processes and concepts. If I had to ask you, if you were to choose a figure that inspired you in writing Patriarchy of the Wage, which would this figure be?
I would not want. I would say a number of feminists. Maria Rosa Della Costa, The Power of Women and the Subversion of Community, that very, very important work that, you know, it was the one actually that, you know, made it possible for me to reconcile my feminism also with the all interest I had for Marxism, because it was the first work that demonstrated that what we call domestic work is actually a form of capitalist production, and connected with Leopoldo Fortunati, The Arcane of Reproduction, which is now being translated again into English. Maria Mies, Fundamental, demonstrating that placing the issue of reproduction, reproductive work on an international level, connecting it with the struggle against colonialism. Making a connection between, the exploitation of women, the devalorization of women's work, and the exploitation and devaluation, of the work of colonial subjects. All of those, and also Selma James, Sex, Race, and Class. It has been an important inspiration. So I would say, and I think this is consistent with the feminist perspective, which tends to stress and value cooperation, collaboration. I think that a number of women have really been important to, have inspired this work and continuously allow me to rethink what reproduction is. Again, this is not a fixed, frozen, essentialized concept, but it's something that is continuously transformed, also in response to the struggle that women have made.
Thank you. That was a proper feminist answer to stress the relevance of the collective of people and figures that we walk alongside. I wanted to now tease another trope or trajectory within the book, which is, of course, your commitment to the commons. And in particular, for the scope of this interview, I think our public would be very interested in trying to grasp how the principle of the commons actually differs from Marx's concept of communism. So how do they two compare?
Yeah, I think, partially the problem of the comparison is that Marx never really elaborated. There's very, very scarce elaboration in Marx on what communism, and I think properly so. Marx pointed out communism is not some sort of, future vision, to be projected in the future, but communism is really the movement that on a day-to-day basis, changes, the organization of society, is the movement that continuously challenges right? The dominance of capitalist relations. So it, in that way, I think that my idea of the commons, you know, is compatible with that view of communism, because Marx has several, you know, entry to the question of what is communism. And I like very much the one in which he looks at communism as not something, you know, a future state only, but rather as something that is already been created in the process of the struggle. And I often say these days that when I think of the commons, I do not think only of something again, you know, a future reality, but I think of what, in my view, more and more is a condition for our struggle. We need to rebuild or build communitarian relations, in effect, to make possible for the struggle to survive and to grow, right? And to build a kind of solidarity that enable us to confront the state with more power. Where I differ from some of Marx's articulation of communism is the relation to the state, right? This idea that it is the first stage, you know, in the anti-capitalist revolution is for the working class to take state power and so on. Well, historically, this not has been, has proven not to be a solution. And in fact, given the great, you know, hierarchies, division, you know, that have been constructed by capitalism in the course of its history, today the idea of state power, you know, it's something that I think we have to reject. You know, a revolution, an anti-capitalist struggle that then creates a state with all its coercive, it's, and of course there are, we know there are a number of states who seem to be inspired by socialist thinking and so forth. But nevertheless, we see that they are continuously making compromises. And because the power relations at level international level are such, it is very difficult to have a state that is completely guided, you know, by politics that are in fact anti-capitalist. You know? So in my view, revolutionary struggle today should not be directed, you know, to create, you know, state power, new form of state power, socialist state power, but should be directed actually of strengthening those community relations and create, of course, network, you know, that can in fact give people, you know, more and more the strength to confront the state. Because otherwise, the compromises that are made once again, and by destroying and destroying your community, create new forms of expropriation. And we see that happening. We have seen that happening in recent time over and over again. So the commons that I see are commons that I think, you know, Marx alluded to, in some of his work, you know, where he spoke of a future society, you know, in which everybody would receive, you know, according to their need, and they would give according to their ability, a future society in which decision would be taken by the collectivity, by the associated producers. Of course, all this depends about what we mean by producer, who are recognized as being the producers. No? So I think that in my view, the question of the commons, it is something that, you know, is in the make. What, how society, because there cannot be also important one universal model. Massimo De Angeli has stressed that over and over and over. We don't have, you know, when we look across the world, how many different historical, cultural, geographical trajectories. So there's not a universal model. As the Zapatistas say, many yeses, many different ways of organizing a just society, of organizing a society not based on the exploitation of human labor, no, not based on the exclusion of anybody in the community from the resources necessary for our life. So many yeses, but one no. The no, which that has to be universal, right? At the core of the commons is no precisely to that exploitation, no to the politics of exclusion, which is really the logic of capitalist society.
Thank you, Silvia. I move to the last question. In chapter 6, which mentions explicitly patriarchy of the wage in its title, and then in the chapter after that, chapter 7, your analysis also focuses on the sexual politics of capital, which segments women themselves along various lines of demarcation, around work, and also respectability. So my question would be, what does it say about the role sex and gender play in capitalism? And how can divisions based on sex and gender be overcome to unify struggles against patriarchal violence today?
Yeah, so, you know, many things. Again, this is a big, big question, but, you know, something. First of all, I want to say that one of the things I tried to show in, you know, those two chapters, no, and again, it connects with the methodology, right? It connects with the methodology that looks at reproduction and domestic work not as something static, but as something that is continually transformed in response to struggle and to the capitalist need for the kind of labor force that they need, right? And what I try to show, for instance, is that, you know, beginning with the last part of the 19th century, you know, capitalism begins to in a very determined way to invest in the reproduction of the workforce, you know, to see the needs, you know, of a workforce that is more physically, emotionally, mentally, you know, equipped, you know, also in conjunction with a transformation in response to a cycle of struggle, and in conjunction with the transformation, you know, in the form of accumulation, right? And so as part of this investment, for example, there is new task for women, right? So that whereas, you know, the older model of the housewife only had to, you know, reproduce children, do domestic work, and of course provide some sexual, you know, the new housewife, for example, has to integrate much more. You know, domestic work has to be much more elaborate, and also sexual work has to be much more present. So the reintegration, for example, of sex work into the domestic labor day, you know, is part of this readjustment, reinvestment, you know, into the reproduction of the working class. So once again, domestic work, not something static, but a continuity, of course, you know, in the history of capitalism has been this separation, you know, between the housewife and the sex worker, the prostitute, you know, the quote, whore, mm-hmm, and the way they have kept women divided. And I think we have done a lot of work. You know, Leopolda Fortunati in The Arcane of Reproduction has dedicated a whole section to this question. You know, why capitalism has needed to criminalize so severely, you know, the woman who survived by selling sexual work, you know, at the very time they actually forced many women, you know, to become sexual workers by depriving them of the basic means of reproduction, by excluding them from so much access to resources and to other forms of work, right? But why, therefore? And the answer, of course, has been, you know, that this is a very important element in the devalorization, you know. Housework had to be seen as a natural, sacred, almost sacred duty of women, as a natural, sacred duty. It's what defines woman as a woman. So they shouldn't be seen as a form of work. Important. So if any attempt to demand a retribution, to be criminalized, to be demonized. I know I've been saying, and I think I want to do it. I've been, you know, playing with the idea of writing a book called Women, Money, and the Devil. Because all through my work in the witch hunts, reconstructing the history of the witch hunts in Europe and outside, there's always this trope. There's always this, at the beginning, the pact with the devil, the pact that the witch presumably made with the devil, right? She usually, the pact begins with the woman despairing, she's poor, she's desperate, the devil appears, says, don't worry, become my servant, I will do everything for you. He gives her some money. And then, of course, they copulate. But then money, within a few days, and this is a theme that occurs, is repeated over and over and over in many books. The money in the course of a few days turns into ashes, turns into dried leaves. And that has intrigued me enormously. Why the demonologists, the inquisitor, felt the need to establish that this money, really the woman could not have it. You know, even the money that she gets from the devil, she cannot have it. And I'm connecting it now, of course, with the whole story in capitalism, in which women are excluded from property, money, they couldn't receive their own wages for a long time, right? This very, and I think it's a very, very crucial topic. And it's a topic that feminist theory has not tackled enough. But I'm very interested in doing this kind of work. So this is what, you know, I began to show in those chapters. And I think that the way of to overcome those decisions, it's really by showing that, you know, the price, first of all, we have paid for this separation, the good woman, the bad woman, the good woman, the bad woman. And it's a separation, I must say, to with a great pain that is continually often in the feminist movement, you know, where, you know, prostitution, sex work, you know, is seen as completely incompatible, you know, with the feminist struggle, you know, and there are some feminists who really do not want to accept this, that in fact, sex work is one of the forms of exploitation that women have engaged in, and that for us to make hierarchies, to decide which forms of exploitation are acceptable and which are not acceptable. It's really to continue to reinforce the division, is to continue to reinforce. So to me, the way to overcome this division the capitalism has created between the good housewife, the good mother, and sacred, almost celebrated on, you know, Mother's Day, and the bad woman, the woman who sells, you know, sex through a prostitution, is basically to say capitalism has put us in a condition to, in fact, having to sell ourselves continuously by forcing our dependence on men, forcing so, you know, deeply our dependence on men. How many women have married, for instance, as an economic, in response to economic necessity? You know, how many women have seen marriage as an economic solution? You know, so it's not up to us to continue to perpetuate this division. It's not up to us to continue to say, you know, which women are acceptable and which are not. So I think that this, we need a movement that fights against all forms of exploitation, you know, and a movement that begins, in fact, to place at the center of feminist politics the valorization of all the activities that are producing and reproducing our life, and the construction of a world where we have access to the means of our reproduction, and we don't have to sell ourselves in marriage, in a factory, or in a sex work. And this is what I think, I hope to contribute to the vision of this struggle, this world, this is what I hope this book will contribute to.
Thanks a lot, Silvia, also for giving us a glimpse possibly into your future work. I'm very excited. I will be very excited to read about money as a feminist issue, hopefully soon. And our interview comes to a close here. And I want to thank a lot Silvia Federici for offering us her insights into this wonderful book, Patriarchy of the Wage, which should be read very widely by all those interested in Marxism, Marxian feminism, gender and reproductive justice, and in the past and present features of the world of work. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandra. Thank you so much. It was great to have this conversation with you.
Many thanks to Alexandra and Silvia for that fascinating discussion. And we hope that you'll subscribe and tune in again soon. This season we'll have two upcoming episodes, where we will interview the other wonderful authors who were shortlisted in 2022, Ilya Budryetskis and Kolya Linna. You can also find more info about the Deutscher Prize and find out how to nominate titles for the prize at our website linked below. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.